things that you talk about, like, how could these people have... What's that? Oh, yeah, you get to actually sit in Bible class now. But I enjoy hearing some of the comments about, you know, like, how could these people do this, you know, and everything. Well, yeah. How can somebody today walk outside on a starry night and say that's all an accident? I mean, we have evidence. They say there's no evidence that God exists. It's not what the Bible says, and all you got to do is look around. So there's no shocks when it comes to the extent that man's nature of sin will go to be able to rebel against God. Even his own people do that. We're looking now at the third major part of the Exodus stage, and that's the book of Numbers. It's easy to count it up because you just go Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Numbers is the third part of the Exodus stage. Exodus stage running from the book of Exodus through the end of the Pentateuch through Deuteronomy. So we pick up where we last left off in our last lesson by looking at an outline for the book of Numbers. And we've already noticed that as all four of these books, this one too has four major sections to it. The book of Numbers is where God has Moses go and Aaron and number the people for breaking them into their armies and the components of being the men of war in preparation for taking and conquering, going into the land of Canaan there. And so we come to the second major section, which is Numbers chapter 10, verse 11, through chapter 21 and verse 35. And this is where I was telling you before. This is where Israel moves. They go up to conquer and begin the conquest of land. But when they get up there, they balk at the whole thing and at the accomplishing of God's purpose. This is the account of sending out, as I said in the last lesson, those 12 spies into the land. And I don't know if I can... Well, it really doesn't matter, but to actually go and look at it. But it's interesting that as you go and look at it, as God chooses and brings, He brings out of each tribe one man who's going to be a spy to go up there, you find two of these guys kind of jump off the page at you. You can find these yourself as you're going through that section. And all of them but two, as I said, Joshua, his name you'll read first of all as Hoshea. And Joshua or Hoshea, and you won't be puzzled at it because God tells you in His Word that if you just keep reading on down, you say, Hoshea, who is this guy? Later on they'll say, that's Joshua. He'll actually say that in the text, that's Hoshea is Joshua. And he was from the tribe of Ephraim, which was a major tribe in the 12 that had a very, we'll say, colorful history. But I always thought it's interesting to just point out the fact that this great warrior by the name of Caleb was a terrific, both of these men were great generals and geniuses when it came to warfare. Probably, you know, I've got this melancholy kind of artsy fartsy bone in my head where I'm a fine arts kind of guy, and I go after these soft spots and things like that. And I really like some of the great even coaches and military generals' speeches that they give to rally their troops. And about once a year, I'll go over. You can get it on the internet and listen to General MacArthur's final speech that he gave at West Point when he was awarded the Thayer Award. And it's just every young man in this country ought to listen to that speech. He says some really stupid things when it comes to evolution and the Bible and some of these things, but he overlooked that. I mean, it's just a terrific speech. And Shakespeare's speech of Henry V, it was probably one of the greatest ones that you'll ever read. And it's you know, the St. Crispin Day speech. It's just incredible. And I got that movie for Christmas just for that one reason. I love that great speech that is given about the band of brothers and that whole thing. Well, if you want to see the quintessence of those kinds of things, read the book of Joshua, especially when you get into the latter chapters of that, when Joshua goes back And he charges these people, and I mean it's one of the greatest speeches that you'll ever hear given, because it's the actual words, living words of the living God. And he really, he's not only a great general, but he knows how to rally the people. And it's just his kind of, it's his version of the State of the Union. As you close up the book of Joshua there, it's just a fantastic one. But Joshua and Caleb, is another guy who is just an all-out warrior. And Caleb is from the tribe of Judah. I always like that because Jesus Christ comes from the tribe of Judah. So of the two, one of these guys comes from Ephraim, the other one comes from the tribe of Judah. And they all these spies are sent out, and they all come back and actually report very positively about what God said about that land. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. It was one of the most prosperous places on the face of the earth. It had grapes that would take two men to carry one cluster. I mean, it was everything God said it was. But they came back with the most negative report that you could have possibly had. They rebelled. They actually rebelled against what God was going to do. They said, there's no way we can go in there and do all of this. This was their mindset. And you probably already are aware of this, I'm sure, but they come back and actually oppose God's instructions to go in and conquer the land because they were afraid. And they were afraid of these people called the children of Anak and these giants that were in the land and all this kind of thing. And they see the opposition of the satanic policy of evil that is now so powerful in that land and gripping that land so powerfully to hold on to it. And the 10 spies come along and they just quiver in their boots. They shake in their boots. And the nations, and the whole nation responds to that by saying, we're not going in there. And they balk at accomplishing God's purpose. They actually determine that they are not fit to do that. That they're unable to do that. To repossess this earth. They even think that they're unable to repossess this little chunk of it, let alone the entirety of the earth. Their failure, and it all stems from what they should have learned back there in the book of Genesis that we talked about, when God takes them through these courses of education and trials of education to learn properly about what God's Jehovahness and grace was all about. Because if they had learned that properly, they would never have balked right here. They would have said, absolutely, I don't care who it is or what they look like. We're going to go in. That's exactly what Caleb and Joshua's attitude was. We're going to go in and kill some giants. Just more targets. That's all. It's always like when I was catching, some big guy had come step into the batter's box. I was never afraid of my pitcher throwing to some big guy. That's just a bigger strike zone, and usually they couldn't hit worth a darn. It was those short little guys with that powerful stroke that was always terrible for me. But these guys get up there and they make all these assumptions, and every one of their problems comes right back to what they had failed to learn in the wilderness from Shur up to Mount Sinai. In that period of time, as soon as they put their signature on that law contract back there in Exodus chapter 19, 20, and so forth, They shut their eyes to God's Jehovahness, and they say, we are going to do this all on our own. We're not even thinking about God's Jehovahness and grace. We're thinking about what we can do, how fit we are. We haven't been tested. We're not battle-proven. We're not this. We're not that. Everything was casting their eyes upon themselves and who they were, instead of upon God and who He is. And that's, you know, that's a critical sonship issue. Because even as we go through our sonship lives, that's what you're going to be. That's one of the reasons why one of the geniuses of God, and the very first thing that He teaches you about when He starts to teach you about the godly decision-making skill of wisdom, is to not think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. And this is one of the things that has incorporated itself into Christianity today, is that one of the things that pastors have to do is have some kind of psychology course and stand up in front of the people and tell them how great they are and get their self-esteem up. When my Heavenly Father makes me to understand and appreciate, I don't have any self-esteem. My self-esteem is cast upon Him. And the only way I'm going to stand, and the only way I'm going to last, is when I see myself as not, and think of myself not highly at all, but I think of myself the way He views me, and I see things through His eyes, and not my own. And that's a sonship issue. But the Israel, they're not being trained as sons here, but still that issue of failing to be able to see themselves as God intended them to be utilized by Him and learn that it wasn't because of themselves, it was because of His Jehovahness and His power and His grace. And instead, once they signed that law contract, they blinded themselves to that. And they shut their eyes to all that and put their eyes totally upon themselves. And the moment they did that, we won't turn to it because I want to take the time to go to some other places here and try to get this done. But the moment they did that, this is the terminology you probably are familiar with, some of you are. They became grasshoppers in the eyes of the children of Anak. And that's what they reported. We're grasshoppers in their eyes. Well, yeah, you are now. That you've got your eyes on yourself. That's about right. That's the summation of it. They forgot the angel of Jehovah is he's walking before them at this point. And actually, they forgot that he said, look, I'm already in the land. All you got to do is just come up here and follow me in. It's a done deal. Well, they balked at that. So then we go to the third major section of the book of Numbers, chapter 22, verse 1 through chapter 25, verse 18. And this is where God, through Balaam, warns Satan and the Gentiles. This is one of the most phenomenal sections of the Bible. God, through Balaam, warns Satan, and very few people are even familiar with this section of God's Word. And these are some of those things I tell you from time to time when I talk about things from the pulpit, what's running through my mind. These are some of the things that run through my mind. I remember what that section is about, Balaam and Balak. And it's where God through Balaam warns Satan and the Gentiles that nothing will thwart his plan and purpose with Israel. Not their tumult, and I use that word tumult for a reason. It's not found there, but later on it gets developed. And that's an important older English expression in God's program with Israel when it comes to the Gentiles and what they're going to try to produce. They become the tumultuous ones later on. But God's going to tell through this guy Balaam, this prophet, he's going to warn both Satan and the Gentiles that nothing will thwart his plan and purpose with Israel, not their tumult and opposition. There's two major sections to this. Not the Gentiles' tumult in opposition, nor Israel's own rebelliousness and stubbornness. Not their stubbornness and rebelliousness, nor the Gentile tumult. And we're going to look at this in pretty much detail when we come to it. And it's, like I said, a phenomenal event. And a major, major issue and section to the Exodus stage, and serves not only as a major issue in connection with God's program with Israel, but it really, really pulls the curtain back so that you can get a good, hard look at the very heart of God, at His integrity, at His character, at what makes Him up and makes Him tick, at His likes, His dislikes, and all the things that endear you to Him as a father to a son and a daughter to a father. And you have that issue coming up here and clearly set on display here in this. Because in the face of everything that Israel was going through and earned and deserved, God still comes along and says, I'm going to still be able, with them and with you Gentiles, to perform and produce exactly what I plan and purpose to do with them all along. Well, this event takes place right on the heels of that balking that of Israel at accomplishing God's plan and purpose, and Israel's rebelliousness and contrariness. And it all comes boiling over, and it results in God saying that He's going to destroy that generation. That's what He's going to do. So outside of those two guys, Moses is going to die on Mount Nebo. He never does get a step foot onto the land. He dies at Mount Nebo. His body is buried, and then there's an interesting issue about where his body is buried. It comes up later on in the book of Jude. But anyway, we're not going to run down that rabbit trail. The only two men that are going to survive this is Joshua and Caleb, and so God is going to destroy. That sends them immediately into this 40-year wilderness wandering. And He's going to destroy that generation, that rebellious generation that balked at going into the land. and he'll take the next generation into the land. So he told them, he comes along and he actually in that section tells Israel to now turn your back on the land, which is amazing, and start heading right back the way you came. And then, of course, some of them come along and say, oh, no, 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 we recognize our wrongdoing. Please, you know, there's always that. We'll put an army together. We'll get it going together, and we'll go up there and fight. But Moses comes along and tells them that God has already turned around. You're not going to win. He's already heading back. He's gone. And if you don't follow him now, it's going to be disastrous for you if you try to go into that land now. And of course, they didn't heed him. So they charge up the mountain. You have an account you'll read in there. And their armies come out. And when they start to fight with those Canaanites, they get beat to pieces. They get destroyed on the battlefield. And they start crying all over again about it. What you've got here in that section is national rebellion taking place. And I'm emphasizing the nationalness of it. And the national stubbornness and contrariness against God. And in the backdrop of all, with the backdrop of all of that, you come to the chapter 22 and verse 1 of the book of Numbers there, and you've got this King Herod of the Canaanites, and as you start going through this section, when you come to chapter 22 and verse 1, you've got Balak, the king of Moab, who is desiring, I'm going to just cover this real quick here, what he does, he desires to get Satan's chief soothsayer to defy Israel and to pronounce and put a curse upon them that'll make it so that they could never, ever be able to do what he understands is their plan and purpose. And you've actually got two things going on here. You've got two things that look like, if ever, for one thing, I don't know if someone was to ask you, where in God's Word is it the very darkest, where God, it looks like it's all done, that there is no way that God can possibly fulfill His plan and purpose. I don't know how many Christians' mind would race to Numbers chapters 22, 23, 24, and 25, but that's where it is. This is one of the darkest moments where it looks like it's going to be the ultimate end of God's capacity to even use Israel. And if that happens, there isn't anybody left. Because one, their national stubbornness and rejection of Him and their refusal to follow Him, their own stupidity and refusal to follow Him. But secondly, the second thing you got going on is Satan's amassing of the Gentiles' strength at the borders of the land to oppose Israel, who are now in their weakest state. Israel has balked. They've gone into this mess where they have tried to go back up and fight on their own without God fighting for them. They've gotten clobbered and hammered, and you've got this satanic amassing of the Gentiles at the borders. And right on the brink of all of that, God does something absolutely marvelous in the face of it all. He takes that very satanic prophet, that man, that soothsayer, of Satan's own choice, his own guy. His name is Balaam. And he sends a message through him back to Satan himself. And through that soothsayer, through Balaam, he's going to send a message right back in the face of Satan, and he's going to send it to those Gentile nations that nothing is going to thwart God's plan and purpose with Israel. Not them and not the adversary. And you have those two things that God stresses in the four, there's four messages that we'll look at that he has Balaam give to Balak. And the first one is, this is so amazing that you can't even hardly say it. But he looks at the situation and he says, I don't see any problem between me and Israel at all. Did you pay attention to what's just happened? God is going to come along and he's going to make an amazing statement. Now, don't worry, because we'll look at it. God's going to be able to come along in the face of Israel, in the rebelliousness that they've spurned following him, but God is able to look at them and he's going to say this: I don't behold any iniquity in Jacob. It's like, have you seen what's been going on here? But that's what he says. I behold no iniquity in Jacob. How can you say that? But he doesn't stop there. The second unbelievable, almost amazing thing he says, God has Balaam turn around and point his finger at Balak and all the other Gentiles and say, basically, I don't see any problem with dealing with you either. I behold no iniquity in Jacob, and I don't have any problem dealing with the likes of you. You don't pose me even a sweat drop of perspiration of how I'm going to get this done. I know exactly how I'm going to get this done. That is a phenomenal thing. God stands right there in front of Satan's own prophet and sends a message right back through him telling Satan, there is nothing you're going to be able to do. You can get my people to rebel against me? I can handle that. I can handle all this. You can put all your people together and become the tumultuous ones that they're going to try to be, and I can deal with all of that too. It poses me no problem. I want to show you something. If we don't get to Deuteronomy, we don't get to it. But come over to Micah chapter 6. Micah chapter 6. Micah's a minor prophet. Now, the minor prophets get a bad rap because they're not minor, because their message is less than the Isaiah or Jeremiah or Daniel. They're minor because they're a whole lot shorter, by and large. But that's a scholar's term. That's not God's term. God doesn't call them minor. It's like the major leagues and minor leagues. It's not like that at all in God's book. Come over to Micah chapter 6. I want you to see, you remember when we were going over the issue of, just preliminarily, when we were going through the book of Exodus and even in Genesis, talking about how God's Jehovah name and his essence and his grace, his Jehovahness and grace, he would bring certain things up to Israel time and time and time again. And the most prolific thing that is brought up over and over and over and over to them is what? In their history that he did for them. The big one that's always brought up. Remember what? Yeah, but he'll always tell them something. You don't have to quote it, but it's always, remember when I did what? And I took you out of Egypt, and I led you through the Red Sea. Remember Egypt. Remember the Red Sea. Remember Egypt. Remember the Red Sea. And there's always this bringing up this issue all the time. Do you realize this is another one that gets brought up to them like that? And most people don't even think about it. But it's so big and huge in God's mind, he brings it back up to them so that they remember this. I want you to see there's something here that God brings up to Israel's memory they need to learn about in what he said to Satan and to the Gentiles through Balaam way back in Numbers. The whole thing comes down again to the issue of God's Jehovahness and grace. When God told Balaam to tell Balak that I behold no iniquity in Jacob, he's referring to what he's going to accomplish by his grace. That's why he could say that. I behold no iniquity in Jacob. Now, which one of God's Jehovahness and grace, of the two, God's Jehovahness, God's grace, which one is dealing deals with the iniquity issue? His grace. He could say that based upon what he's going to accomplish by his grace. He could say, I behold no iniquity in Jacob. Because by his grace, What's the major thing His grace is going to provide for them? Redemption, exactly. And when God tells Balaam to tell Balak, I don't see any problem in dealing with all your these other nations either, and all your tumult of the two, you've only got one left. He's referring to the fact that he's going to be able to do by His Jehovahness, by His righteousness, by His power, by His almightiness, to deal with whatever mass opposition Satan and those Gentiles ever put together. He's going to deal with it. Micah is one of those fifth course of punishment prophets, and Micah functions. He's in the list of prophets down here, and he functions during the time that Israel is in their fifth course of punishment. He is an actual living in the fifth course of punishment prophet. And as this prophecy unfolds here in Micah, he's given to see things both at the beginning of the fifth course of punishment in the first course, and now he's going to look out toward the fifth course of punishment as well. And pick it up in chapter 6 at verse 1. He says, hear ye now what the Lord saith, arise, contend thou before the mountains, and let the hills hear thy voice. Hear ye, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and ye strong foundations of the earth, for the Lord hath a controversy with His people, and He will plead with Israel. Now, this is the commencement, actually, of the fifth course of punishment. He's going to gather that up, and he's going to kind of sweep through the thing. But then he comes along in verse 3. It's fascinating. He says, O my people, what have I done to thee? And wherein have I wearied thee? Testify against me. That's not God coming along and saying, oh, what have I done? You know, this isn't some kind of wishy-washy plea like God's actually done something, as if He's overstepped His bounds and done something bad to them in all of their history. That's not how this is worded. That's Him coming along and saying, you tell me what I've done to get you into this mess. That's basically what He's saying. What have I done? Tell me what I've done to get you into the mess that you're in, into this fifth course of punishment where you're going to be thrown, you're going to be spewed out of your own land. You're going to go through the Assyrian captivity, the Babylonian captivity. You're going to go through the Medo-Persian captivity. You're going to go through 400 years of silence. Then you're going to have the rebelliousness where you're going to actually defy and crucify your own Messiah. Finally, I'm going to have my day of wrath poured out on you. Now, what have I done to get you into this mess? Go ahead, testify against me. It comes out loud and clear, almost sarcastic. I've done nothing to get you into this mess. You've gotten yourself into this mess, and that's why he says, testify against me at the end of verse 3. Look at verse 4. For I brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. There it is. And redeemed thee out of the house of servants. And I sent before thee Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, consulted, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him from Shittim to Gilgal, that ye may know the righteousness of the capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D of Jehovah. That's what they needed to learn at this time, the righteousness of the Lord. They needed to understand the righteousness of God's dealings with them. He dealt rightly with them, righteously with them. What they have, they earned. They didn't cast themselves on what they could have had. They actually picked it up and carried the ball and fumbled it. God is the one who remained faithful and loyal, and they need to understand and how it is that God was going to be able to set everything straight in view of the mess that they were in and the predicament they put themselves in and gotten themselves into, and what they're going to need to learn is to go back to the book of Numbers and learn the lessons that Balaam spit back, and I mean he spit it right back into the face of Balak when God utilized Balaam to send his message back. In other words, they need to go back and remind themselves of those two issues. One, the fact that in the face of all of Israel's rebellion, God wouldn't behold iniquity in Jacob. He's not going to behold iniquity in them. He has a Redeemer who is going to come, and he's going to provide for their sins, and he's got a prescription for their cleansing that's going to include the confession of their sins and the sins of their fathers and the baptisms, all of those things that provide for that. God's provided for all of that. And he's got it to where he can actually make of a true statement and say, I don't see iniquity in Jacob. I don't behold iniquity in them. And the other issue, the second one, even in the face of all the Gentile tumult, their opposition to destroy God and his purpose and retain this earth for themselves, that's not going to cause him a problem either. And the two issues of God's grace and God's Jehovahness, Israel's salvation and Israel's hope for ever being what God planned and purposed for them to be, all rests on those two things. Those are the pillars for the plan and purpose God has with them to be fulfilled. His Jehovahness and His grace. And that takes us then to the fourth component of the third part of the Exodus stage, the book of Numbers. And that's chapter 26, verse 1 through 36, the end of the book, verse 13. And that describes the issue of the 40 years of wilderness wanderings. It describes once they balk at it up there in the second component to it, the spies are sent out. God has this interlude where he purposely does what he does with Balaam here to be able to set it in their history and in their minds as a part of their doctrine that God, by his Jehovahness and grace, doesn't behold iniquity in Jacob, and the Gentiles pose no threat under Satan's own men and policy of evil. But he now sends them into 40 years wilderness till that generation dies out. And this describes the issue of the 40 years of wilderness wanderings. And at the end of that thing, God comes along and has them numbered again. He numbers, renumbers the nation. God numbers the nation of Israel again. And it says that after the 40 years, Israel is numbered again. The rebellious generation's been destroyed. And again, this is one of those places where things are supposed to start getting better now. But it doesn't last long. Just a teensy moment almost. And then that attitude is still there. And the rebellious generation is destroyed. God numbers the nation again for their armies. And in that section, the lessons of the past are reviewed and preparations made then to enter the land for its conquest. And that leaves only one last thing for Moses to do. And the last thing he's going to do is the last book that we'll look at here. Part four is the Deuteronomy. And he's going to rehearse the law a second time before they go into the land, before Joshua takes them in, so that all of those issues that were touched upon are now burning in their ears and in their soul as they go in. Well, we're really out of time for me to go through all of this. It wouldn't take all that long, but probably longer than we have for the rest of our class here. So I think I'll stop it there and just finish this on Sunday. And then what we're going to do is we're going to dive back into the book of Exodus there and start hitting those five major areas. Some of them, again, when something I know is well understood by you, I'm not going to go into minutia on it or anything like that, but I will hit it and we will go over some of the pertinent verses to it. And it's just kind of me getting a sense of where you are. And some of it's just going to be review or bringing things back up to your memory. But I think it's important that we do go over it. Some of you may not have heard it before, may not be quite as familiar with it from when we first went over it. And I never have gone over this in this kind of a format. It's always just been kind of hit and miss when things would come up. So, unfortunately, I guess I talked too much in the first session, but I wanted to get through all four of these books. But there's not a lot to go over here with Deuteronomy, but there is a section on it that is going to be major to what we're going to study, because we will be looking at the issue of the at near the end of the book, the additional covenant, oftentimes called the Palestinian covenant. That's a big issue. And the issue of what Moses' last acts are. And those last acts have two issues that pertain to them that's really important to you being able to make some connections. The Song of Moses that comes up in chapter 32 is a major issue. And then Moses, at the end of this, of Deuteronomy, goes through and he takes all 12 tribes and blesses them before he dies. But the whole book ends up with a very strong appeal that everything they are or ever will be is not because of themselves under that law contract. Moses had learned his lesson. But by God's own Jehovahness, he will do for them what they couldn't do for themselves. And that land is going to be theirs on that basis alone. And that's kind of the last thing that's in their ears before Joshua then leads them across the Jordan River. But we'll get a little bit more of an understanding of those things on Sunday morning. Finish this out, the four sections to Deuteronomy, and then we'll start looking at those other pertinent issues. So that's about it for tonight. I think we'll stop right there.